Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update. We're now in April of 2014. This is a weekly program that examines the economic dimensions of our lives, our jobs, our incomes, our debts, our hopes, the prices we pay, the cost of our children's education, all of it. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life. I currently teach at the New School University in New York City. I also write regular columns for truthout.org, an independent and courageous source of economic analysis, but all kinds of other analysis as well. It's a critical perspective, but one I think you will find a lot to learn from. Check them out at truthout.org. If this program provides you with materials you're interested in, please know that we maintain two websites that can give you more of this kind of analysis, provide you with documentation, with interviews, with entire classes in economics, as you like, completely free of charge, available to you 24/7. The first of the two websites is rdwolf.com, and the second one is democracyatwork.info. Not only will they provide you with lots of interesting materials, but there are two other things about these websites I would like to bring to your attention. First, this is a way to communicate with us, to send us your thoughts, your suggestions, your criticisms, and your questions. For those of you that listen, you know that toward the end of every program, we deal with one or two of the questions we get, the many emails we get, in order to respond to what you want us to analyze. Please know that we will read all of the emails. We use them to shape our programs, and so your effort to communicate is really effective. Of course, we can't answer all your questions. There are simply too many, and we are very pleased to receive them, I should say. The second thing you can do on our website is click on the relevant icon, and you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest to keep in charge. You can also sign up for our free newsletter, where we will bring some of our activities to your attention every 2 or 3 months, just to keep in contact with you. Lastly, during the month of April, I will be giving talks, public talks, in the following places in case you're interested. In St. Louis, between the 7th and 9th of April. In Omaha, between the 5th and the 15th and 16th of April. In Portland, Maine, on the 23rd and 24th of April, and in Providence and Kingston, Rhode Island, on the 29th. It's a busy month for me, and I'm very pleased that the interest is there to make these kinds of events happen. I will be very pleased in a few minutes to introduce my guest for today. I think you'll find what she has to say extraordinarily interesting. But as usual, we'll begin with our shorter updates. Well, the big news this last week was a decision by the Supreme Court of the United States. And that decision involved removing what are called the aggregate cap limits, the total amount of money that wealthy people can give to the political candidates, parties, and so on of their choice. A case had been brought by a person who wanted to give more than the $123,000 that are the maximum. I know this will come as a real constraint on many of you, my listeners, who are, of course, interested in giving $123,000 or rather more than that to the candidates you like. The Supreme Court decided in a split decision, 5-4, to allow wealthy people to give even more money to the candidates they wish to see prevail. What can I say about this as an economist and someone looking at the economic aspects? Well, it's one more step, really one of many, in the direction of making politics a commodity, even more than it was, something that you can buy and shape in the way you like. The old joke that we have the best democracy money can buy has now no longer become a joke. It's simply a description of what we have. We don't just have the best democracy that money can buy. We have a kind of democracy with the word democracy now belonging in quotation marks because the buying is what the dominant reality is. Look, it was always true that those who had more money had more political power. They could influence other people in countless ways. They could get around the laws if they needed to, plus they could make the laws more friendly. What we see here is making the law more friendly to allow those with the money to dominate. And we understand why they have to do it. Now that the gap between rich and poor has become as enormous as it is of course prudent for those at the top to be worried that their extraordinary wealth, happening as they defraud or deplete the resources that the rest of us have to live on, that they're going to be nervous that we might use our majority, we are the majority after all, that we might use our majority politically to undo what they have done economically. And to prevent that from happening, they need to control politics. And that's what this is all about. But it leads us to the following comment. Every other society, empire, wealthy society, that has taken this road of becoming more and more unequal and then stifling politics so it cannot threaten that inequality has ended up destroying itself. That's the real issue that's being put before the American people. Will they allow it to go down this road, or will the people make a difference by saying, no, this can't continue? The second update I want to bring to your attention has to do with the elections about a week ago in France. The French government is unusual in Europe in the sense that it is entirely socialist. The president is a socialist. The General Assembly, the National Assembly it's called there, is dominated by the Socialist Party, and the Senate is majority socialist. So it's a 1-2-3 socialist sweep of the French government. Well, last week were municipal elections, that is, not elections for Senate or Assembly or President, elections for local city. And in that election, the Socialist Party was badly defeated. That is, a huge number of French cities voted out their socialist leaders, mayors and so on, and voted in conservatives. What are we to make of this? Well, I think there are several lessons here, not only for France and Europe, but things for Americans and people around the world to pay some attention to. First, a huge number of French people, more than in any election in memory, didn't vote. And it's clear that most of those who didn't vote were socialists. That is, they would have voted for the socialists. They did vote for them to sweep them into power the way I just described. But they've been so disgusted by the socialist government's reneging on the deals and promises it made. The socialists came into power by saying they wouldn't allow austerity, they wouldn't allow this economic crisis of capitalism to be solved on the backs of the mass of people, with cutbacks of services, cutbacks of government jobs, raising of taxes on average people. They wouldn't permit it. In effect, they did permit it. They did a little bit of what they had promised and a good bit of the austerity that they had set themselves against. And the response of the mass of people has been to say, well, we still prefer the socialists over the others, but we're not going to vote for them because they've made it impossible. 36% of the total French population did not go to the polls. In this country, that would not be remarkable, but in France, it is, because political participation in that country is much higher than that in the United States. But particularly interesting and alarming is the fact that for people aged 18 to 24, 39% voted, 61% did not go to the polls. That is, almost two-thirds of the young people of France voted with their feet by not voting. So it's a remarkable turning against a government that was pledged to fight austerity and didn't deliver on the pledge. And that might be a warning. It's also powerful that what's happening in France is a kind of disgust with both parties. The conservatives did not go up very much in their votes. It's that the socialists didn't show up. There's a recent poll that shows that 70% of the French people believe their political class, those who govern them, of all parties, are corrupt and untrustworthy. 70% of the poll. One interesting thing that happened in the elections was the first time a major French city, in this case the city of Grenoble in the south of France, saw the victory of the Green Party that took over the government of that city, pledged to do the kinds of things that Green parties, particularly on the left end of the spectrum of Green parties, promised to do. And so we will be interested in seeing what difference that makes to French and European politics. The third update for today has to do with an impact of this movement around the country to raise the minimum wage. Currently, the minimum wage is at $7.25 an hour. The president and a number of organizations are trying to raise it. The benchmark price that they're looking at is $10.10 an hour. But we even have some places in the United States, Seattle is the most well-known right now, where there's an effort afoot to get a minimum wage of $15 an hour. And one of the things I wanted to bring to everyone's attention is that raising the minimum wage has a disproportionate effect on women. In other words, it will be women whose situation is improved specifically by the minimum wage. And there are many ways in which that's true. I mean, the most general is that women have lower paid jobs than men across the board. And therefore, if you raise the bottom, it's going to disproportionately affect women. But there are a number of other ways that this is true. Many people do not know that there are exceptions to the minimum wage. There are certain kinds of jobs that are relieved from paying $7.25. The most egregious, there really is no polite word for this, the most horrific example is the tip job. That is, the law specifically says that if you are working in a job where you get tips for what you do, waiter, waitress, things like that, then the employer who hires you does not have to pay you $7.25. The employer only has to pay you $2.13 an hour. That's the federal minimum tipped wage. The idea behind this was, well, this kind of person gets a tip on top of whatever he or she gets as a wage, and so that shouldn't apply. That was a naked gift to all of the big employers who run the fast food joints of this country, as well as the smaller restaurants, bars, and so on. More horrific is the fact that the $2.13 has not been increased for 40 years, for the last 40 years. The regular minimum wage has been raised, not enough and not often. That's why it's still at $7.25, but at least it has been raised. For tipped workers, it hasn't been raised. The overwhelming majority of tipped workers are women. In some professions, as much as 80%. So if you did something finally about raising the minimum wage, and if you did something about raising the minimum wage, particularly for tipped workers, which is now at $2.13 an hour, we would be doing something of particular importance to women. And that's a dimension of the struggle over the minimum wage that I think you ought to have in your mind and be aware of, as to who the victims are of not doing it and who the beneficiaries would be if we did it. Final story. A big interview last week, on widely reported on television, between the head of Starbucks company and Mr. Schultz and the television personality Oprah Winfrey. They were getting together to do a joint campaign. They're working together now, and they had the usual smiley session on the TV talking about their collaboration. In the course of their interview, which was about how they're going to be working together, this major woman in American culture and this major head of a corporation we all know, Starbucks, Mr. Schultz was asked what he thinks about raising the minimum wage, since, of course, Starbucks is one of the places where wages are not high. He thought it wasn't a good idea to raise wages to $15 an hour, because some people, he thought, might lose their jobs. That Oprah Winfrey could sit there with this fellow, knowing that women to whom she addresses much of her work are the ones who would benefit most from raising a minimum wage, that she could sit there with a man whose salary is in the many, many millions of dollars, who earns thousands an hour and is explaining why other people shouldn't get 15 an hour, who makes his profits because people get paid low wages, is something we might all want to think about. Last short update for today. It was reported by Bloomberg Financial Services last week that American corporations had nearly $2 trillion in money sitting on their balance sheets that they're not investing. Now, folks, that's the reason why we have high unemployment, that the corporations who are the ones who hire, who want us to celebrate them as, quote-unquote, job creators, are not doing that. They're not creating jobs. They're sitting on the money that could create jobs. They have been doing that for a long time. They just decided it isn't profitable. And the way our economic system works, if the ones who have the money decide it isn't profitable, the rest of us pay the price in unemployment. Bloomberg, in the same report, points that almost as much, another $2 trillion, is held in cash outside the United States. Why are corporations doing that? Because they get away with paying lower taxes if they keep their money abroad. And one of the examples that was publicized last week by Senator Carl Levin and the Senate Investigative Committee that he heads was the Caterpillar Corporation of the American Midwest, the big tractor and machine company. Turns out they have evaded taxes. $2.13 billion over the last 10 years was the estimate of the United States Senate, by a phony subsidiary in a foreign country that they used to hide their profits over there, pay much lower taxes there than they would have paid in the United States. So not only do corporations holding cash mean we don't have jobs, but corporations holding cash abroad mean that our government doesn't have tax monies which it could use to provide the services we need, partly because so many of us are unemployed. The same entity is making the two decisions, to hold the cash and not invest it, and to keep it abroad. And we suffer twice. It's the way this system works. All of that's legal. But it's legal because those who benefit made sure the law worked that way. Okay, so much for our short updates. Let me turn then to introduce my guest today, Vanessa Brandsburg. Thank you, Vanessa, very much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Let me tell you a little bit about Vanessa before we start talking. Vanessa Brandsburg is the Director of Cooperative Development at the Center for Family Life in Brooklyn, New York. Since February 2008, she has been providing co-op incubation consultation. Well, that's a nice way of saying she's helping co-ops get developed, begin, and grow. And she's been doing it in Sunset Park, which is a part of Brooklyn. There, she has particularly worked, and that's what we're going to be discussing with her, worker-owned cooperative businesses run by immigrants that have arrived in Brooklyn, New York. In the last couple of years, Vanessa has been at the forefront of creating and running the New York City Cooperative Development Initiative, which provides year-long support to community-based organizations in New York as they learn to become practitioners in cooperative worker enterprise development. Vanessa is also one of the founders of the New York City Network of Worker Cooperatives, which we all know here as NICNOC. And she serves on the board as well of the U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives. So let's start, Vanessa, by asking you to tell us a little bit about the Center of Family Life in Brooklyn, what it is, what it does.
Sure, my pleasure. So the Center for Family Life was established in 1978. It's a program of SCO Family of Services, which is a larger agency that has programs all over New York City. And the Center for Family Life really started actually by two nuns of the Good Shepherd, just doing family counseling and foster care work in Sunset Park neighborhood, very locally. And then over the years, it's really expanded to have about 9 different programs, at like after school, community services program with a food pantry, different arts programs, and so forth. And where I am based is the Adult Employment Program, and that's where the Worker Co-op Project really came out of. So basically, the Center for Family Life has really taken the decision to go in the direction of developing worker-owned co-ops back in 2006, when we really saw a need to work with people in the neighborhood that were experiencing multiple barriers to employment, where the traditional employment program wasn't able to meet. So we really started looking and investigating into models that had, you know, obviously been used all over the world for many, many years, but more recently with immigrants in the United States, reaching out to folks in California, here locally in Long Island and in Staten Island.
You know, I'm struck by it because I have talked on this program fairly often about the Mondragon Corporation, mm-hmm. this extraordinarily successful set, really a family of worker co-ops in Spain. Mm-hmm. And they started also as an action of the Catholic Church, of mm-hmm. a priest, Arizmendi, in the north of Spain, the Basque territory, 1956, a handful of six workers. And here we are, half a century later, 100,000 people involved in this mm-hmm. operation. It is proof that worker co-ops not only can survive, but can grow, can go from small enterprises to large enterprises. And you know, the interesting thing that the historians say is that they made the decision, this Catholic priest, mm-hmm. to go in the direction of co-op precisely for the reason you just said, that waiting for capitalist enterprises, mm-hmm. people interested in making a profit in the conventional way, was simply taking too long mm-hmm. and leading to too much suffering of too many people over too long a period of time, and that mm-hmm. this alternative model, the co-op, right. would be a way to do what a conventional enterprise strategy wouldn't achieve. Is that similar in a sense
yes.
to what you arrived at the Center for Family Life?
Yeah, it's very similar because the reality was that the folks that we were working with, mostly immigrants, recent immigrants, were just left out of the system. And so there were really no alternatives to finding good living wage jobs except for the exploitative positions that they had been holding, doing domestic work, working at factories in the waterfront, working at restaurants. And so they wanted something different. And there were really no other options. So we had to recreate that with our own standard, in our own way.
So let's get into the nitty-gritty. Tell us about the cooperative that has been the major project and the major achievement of your work over the last few years. Mm-hmm. And give us, you know, your own sense and your own feelings about that kind of work.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's two cooperatives that have been extremely successful that I have been partnering with in the last few years. The first one, which was the first co-op that we worked with, is called Si Se Puede Women's Cleaning Cooperative, or in English, We Can Do It. The women came together in 2006. It was about 15 people at the time, 15 founding members. And really,
all women?
All women, mm-hmm. exactly. They had been using ESL classes, family counseling in the program, so we already had a relationship with them. So that trust was already developed. And we approached them and said, hey, you know, we know that it's been something that you've been desiring to have pursue entrepreneurship. Have you heard of the co-op model? A lot of them actually identified with that because of where they came from, either from Mexico or Puerto Rico. It's very natural. And then we started looking at different industries, and it made most sense to go into the cleaning services because it's something that they had already known to do. So the skills were already there, so that wouldn't have been an uphill battle at all. And we started working with them to develop the business skills. So we started doing business planning. We started doing the brand development. We talked about marketing strategies. And in between those sessions, we also started doing peer training around cleaning services. So they started teaching one another. And then we really started connecting with our different networks around to build a client base. And the women were very eager to do this. It wasn't easy because they had to basically put forward a lot of time. It wasn't so much monetary investment, but it was more sweat equity in terms of coming to meetings to plan, you know, forming committees, doing marketing and hitting the streets to do that. And we went alongside with them to do that. And over the years, what we've seen is they've grown tremendously in terms of the demand. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that their clients really understand where they're coming from and really want to do the right thing and support a social, you know, a worker-owned business that's being led by its owners. So they know that the people doing the cleaning have a really big stake in it. So what we've seen over the years is tremendous is before joining the cooperative, a lot of the women were earning maybe $7 to $10 an hour doing cleaning, sometimes being asked to do childcare at the same time, which is difficult to do both. And now in CSIP, whether they're earning between, you know, $20 to $25 an hour, depending on how much they work. Some people choose to do full-time, some part-time. So it's been a tremendous leap income-wise, which of course affects their family, you know, situation.
I'd like to pick up on many dimensions of mm-hmm. what you said, but here's a couple. I'm struck by what you say about the ability of these women in that co-op to find clients, folks who will buy the services they're mm-hmm. producing, who want not just to get their place clean, mm-hmm. their store, their factory, their office, whatever it is, but who also want to buy something from an entity whose way of organizing work they want to help. In other
yes.
words, it gives them a competitive advantage yes. in the marketplace mm-hmm. that they, in a sense, offer a customer two things, the cleaning service, mm-hmm. but also the chance to help build mm-hmm. a co-op sector in the community. Mm-hmm. And for many clients, this matters. Mm-hmm. This isn't they would make a choice for a co-op rather than a conventional mm-hmm. business.
That's right.
Because many folks wonder whether a co-op can succeed in the capitalist marketplace. You're basically saying,
it's
here's
super
one that
competitive.
Did.
Yeah, absolutely. It's incredible. And I think it has to do with the fact that, people are really seeking out, you know, how to have a relationship with the person that's engaging with them and their family and their home, and not to hire somebody from an agency where there's a middleman and everything's very vague and they don't really know what's happening. And to know that it's women not just cleaning, but they're also producing a product right now, a cleaning product. They're becoming leaders. They're in the forefront of the network that you mentioned. So it's much more than that. So I think people really buy into all of that. And so they're very different. They set themselves apart very much from all the other cleaning companies in New York City that exist.
Tell our listeners and tell me, how has the business grown over the years that it has been? Give us a sense of a little mini history mm-hmm. of this effort. How many women have been involved over time? What changes in the way they're functioning have you observed? Mm-hmm. How have you helped them? A little bit of the history.
Yeah. So it started out, as I was saying, with 15 members, over probably the first year and a half was a very challenging time where they had to get things going and really develop themselves and their reputation in the marketplace. After about a year and a half, the demand was so high that they couldn't meet it, so they brought in 10 new members, so they became 25. And actually, since 2008, they've grown to 60 members in the
60.
Cooperative. 60. They just brought in 10 people. They just finished a probationary period that's 3 months long. It's very intense where they train them to do cleaning. And through the years, you know, I've seen tremendous, challenges come up and learnings, things having to do with, you know, the complexity around decision making in the co-op and having, you know, 30 people in the room and really figuring out a way to hear all the voices as in worker co-ops, you know, everybody has a vote. So they've sort of played around with majority vote, with consensus decision. We've provided a lot of trainings in those things, how to be effective communicators, which is very tricky in a co-op. But that's the goal. So they meet every other week for the last, they've met every
they
other week.
They being all of them.
All of them. They're very into being very participatory. They do have committees, like a leadership committee. There is a training committee and also a publicity committee that oversees, you know, kind of the vision and keeps things going. But they're very committed to meeting every other week for the last 8 years and still do, to really talk about what's going on with clients, with members, issues to resolve, challenges that come up. So we've been there, you know, along the way. Obviously, our relationship changes because they need us less, and that's our role as an incubator. But we've trained them in doing the back office. Again, we do many trainings. We come in and do consultation on different, like, issues that come up around management and governance issues. And we share a space. So we're very in tune to one another in terms of what's going on. And I think they're going to continue growing because the demand just continues to come. They've increased their client base by 40% last year. So they're doing really well in terms of people being interested in their services.
Let me ask you a couple of questions before we get to the mid-program break. When they bring in new people, when they did that in stages, if mm-hmm. I understand you, are the new people that are brought in after their probation period, Are they then fully equal members, no different basically in their decision-making power from those who started it at the very beginning? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, in some co-ops, that becomes a tension, that the old ones, the ones who started it, kind of because of the way we live in our society, think they ought to have powers that new ones don't. How do they work that out?
Yeah, that's very familiar. Not initially. So when somebody is brought into the co-op to be trained and go through what they call a probationary period, they don't have a vote in the co-op. So they have to do specific trainings. They have to be evaluated by clients and the members. They have to attend meetings. They have to do publicity. And so after these three-month period, the members look back to see the trajectory of their probationary period and make a decision whether they're in or they're out. If they are chosen to come in, they pay an investment into the co-op, which is not a huge amount, and then they get a vote, and they become the same as all of the other members. Okay. But to what you're referring to, I think they call the founder syndrome, definitely is happening in the co-ops. Yeah, I think it's a very natural thing. And so that is something that, you know, gets in the way sometimes, where the original generations, as they call themselves, the co-op members, are saying, I started this from nothing, you know, I know more than you, it's easy for you. But we try to balance that out with the great ideas and new visions that people have coming in newly in the co-op.
Okay, folks, we're going to take our mid-program break right now. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a few minutes to continue the interview with Vanessa Brandsburg about co-ops, worker co-ops in Brooklyn, New York. Welcome back, folks. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update. I want to remind you again to follow our work on our two websites, rdwolff.com and democracyatwork.info. I also want to remind you that you can communicate to us through those websites, as well as follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. I want to resume the interview I'm having with Vanessa Brandsburg, who works with the Center for Family Life in Brooklyn, and who has been talking to us about a very successful co-op, worker co-op project of immigrant women doing cleaning services in Brooklyn, grown from 15 to 60 people. And we've been talking about some of the nitty-gritty kind of issues, and I want to return to that. Is it possible that this kind of a model, besides all of its attractiveness for workers across the board, upper income, lower income, highly skilled, less skilled, middle income people, poor people, and so on, might have some special relevance to trying to get folks that are poor out of that situation, something which other programs that don't question how you organize business haven't been able to do. Tell us how that is shaping up as part of what you've learned and, mm-hmm. and what you're doing in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm. That's actually been very much at the core of why we've started doing this work. Absolutely. It's been, a strategy, I think, to look at the fact that with the co-ops, people are trained in a way and kind of, brought into the marketplace in a way that they otherwise wouldn't have been able to because of, their low, not being skilled, not having the language necessary to pursue certain jobs. And so with this, I think they are brought in just very concrete examples. You know, with a co-op, they have contracts, for example, that they use with clients. And so they're able to negotiate with them and be able to really present themselves in a different way. So the messaging is really powerful. Also coming at a client in a collective way, I think really makes a difference in terms of, the impact that they can have in their job economically. And so this has been a really powerful tool, I think, for people to really kind of step out of their shell and be able to think of themselves differently and have a lot more agency over kind of how they're pursuing their ability to work in this country.
Yeah, it's the old lesson, yeah. I guess, that if you have a job you're proud of and you're working with people you feel good about, mm-hmm. it changes you. As whatever work you do for others, you're also transforming yourself in the process.
Yeah.
And the defense and the argument for co-ops has always been that it's a much better way to live as a human being, mm-hmm. to be part of a job where you have power, where you are part of the design and the direction of the job and not just a drone doing what other people tell you. What have been some of the problems? Let's be honest with our audience. Mm-hmm. What have been some of the major problems confronting this co-op, and how were those problems dealt with?
Yeah, so there's been numerous challenges along the way. First of all, we know that the majority of small businesses that start up fail in the first year, about 50%.
Not co-ops, that's all businesses.
All businesses, right. Across the board. Yeah, this includes co-ops. And so it's a really big risk for people to just set aside their personal lives and also the fact that they live in a household, oftentimes, the community that I work with, where there are multiple earners, wage
right.
earners. And to really just do this for no wage, maybe for a year to 2 years, knowing that it might not work. So that's one big first hurdle to kind of go through. Another is, just to be completely, transparent, the fact that when working in a co-op, you have to be very conscientious of your identity in the group and be able to use yourself in a professional way and to be an effective communicator, to be able to get things across and also to make progress. So there's definitely conflict that comes up, and that's something that we work with a co-op on. So that's a very real thing that I think sometimes co-ops themselves don't recognize in kind of the formation phase.
So the group process sort of.
Yeah, definitely. Another sort of issue that comes up is around, being able to develop your identity as a cooperator. So what I mean by this is that, we live in a society where we're, very accustomed to being typically an employee with an employer, following our boss's instructions, and then working 9 to 5, and that's it. And so in this case, you really have to kind of be able to unlearn that and take a leadership role and be able to be your own boss and to hold people accountable and to be able to use that identity in different aspects of your life, not just in the workplace, but in the meetings, with your family, in the community. So it's really a fascinating kind of learning experience that, takes some folks longer than others.
Tell me, how did you solve these problems? When you had people who couldn't do that or who took a long time or who resisted it because of the way we live in our society, it's hard to work together with other people. That's why it's so hard to get movements going because mm-hmm. it's a very individual. How did you solve these
yeah.
problems?
It's an ongoing you know, job and work to kind of deal with these kinds of issues that come up. But basically, you know, I think we have a certain model at the Center for Family Life that we work with the co-ops on called social group work, where we basically help to kind of be very transparent about what's going on in a group. So if somebody's being confrontational about something, you know, we kind of make it known and we try to work through those issues together. Sometimes it makes more sense to work within the committees. There's also a lot of rules that the co-ops have within their bylaws that they have to abide by and take certain steps if there's a problem with an individual or with two individuals together. So they take certain specific steps to kind of, you know, give a warning, maybe suspension, you know, whatever needs to happen. And then along the way, you know, it's definitely something that's brought up in terms of different workshops and being modeled, you know, by other cooperatives that we come across. So the networking, I think, is a really great aspect, you know, coming across other co-ops that are doing similar, that are confronting similar challenges and learning from them as well.
I want to pick up on that. Have there been spin-offs? Have there been other co-op, worker co-ops formed in Sunset Park, mm-hmm. in Brooklyn, that were brought into being, in a sense, by the success of Si Se Puede?
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about
definitely.
That.
Definitely. We learned so much from our experience with Si Se Puede that we've actually been doing incubation for the last 8 years with 7 additional cooperatives. So it's Si Se Puede is like the first one. And after that, we've worked with Beyond Care, which is a nanny cooperative, which I would say is as successful as Si Se Puede. They started out with 19 founding members and now are 35 and bringing in 12 new people. And then there's a few startups that we're working with.
What kind of work are these startups into? What do they do?
So one of them is called Trusty Amigos, and they're doing dog walking and pet sitting. Okay. They started last year. So they're about to launch next month, actually, to the public. Another co-op is called Golden Steps. It's an elder care, non-medical companionship service. And they work in all 5 boroughs, and they've been together for about 2 years. And then lastly, there is another co-op called Kickin' It, and it's mostly run by young people under the age of 25, providing soccer coaching and training to people in the neighborhood.
So it's very interesting. So it's a whole range of service industry mm-hmm. startups mm-hmm. that are set up as co-ops.
Yes.
Okay, tell me, based on all of this, what do you think about the co-op movement? You sit on a national co-op mm-hmm. organization. What do you think might be the role of co-ops in the United States? Here we are in an economy that is having a long-lasting crisis, that has millions of people unemployed, that is taking away job benefits and job securities from most people. Mm-hmm. We really all have that. It's only a question of the rate at which we're losing them, not whether we are. Where do co-ops and this movement that you're part of to build, where does that fit into all of that?
Mm-hmm. I think cooperatives have had a place in society, but can play a much larger role. And I think really it's an example that they set for a type of workplace that would benefit people on different dimensions, as you were mentioning, both economically but also in the human factor. So the fact that, you know, co-ops are run democratically to really make sure that people's voices are heard is something that we could really gain a lot from in this economy and the society, and really have the potential and have been actually to compete in the marketplace and to be able to really fit in the major in society. And so, you know, I think it really is something to look at, you know, in contrast to all of the exploitative kind of workplaces that we're seeing, and to be able to go from that. So,
yeah, I wanted to make a comment too. It's wonderful to hear the concrete reality mm-hmm. of this on the ground, that it's working, that it is transforming people's lives. I am concerned, as I mentioned to you before the program, that the benefits of the co-op as a way to help unemployed people, poor people, immigrants, not take away from the fact that most people involved in co-ops are not from those groups, mm-hmm. that co-ops are as important a way of becoming a full member of society, of realizing all your own individual potentials, mm-hmm. which are not just to do work instructed by others, but to be part of the design of the instructions, mm-hmm. to be part of the decision making, that this is a movement to change the way we organize work that really does, as it should, appeal to people across mm-hmm. the bound. if it can also serve as a way to help deal with the problem of poverty, well, that's yet another benefit, another virtue this has had. And it is clear, that's why I introduced the Mondragon, that the most successful example is a place that started as a program to help poor people, mm-hmm. but has since mushroomed to help all kinds of people that are neither Basque nor poor nor anything else, because it's a model that has such appeal. So tell me, are you going to be doing more? And particularly, I know many people have asked me, I want to start, they say to me in emails, mm-hmm. I want to start a co-op, but I don't know anything about it. Sure. Who's going to help me? Tell us something about not only your group, but are there comparable groups around the United States mm-hmm. that folks who want to start this thing can turn to for all the kinds of help and support and training that you provided in Brooklyn?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. We are going to definitely continue doing the work that we've been doing locally. We've also not only just been working with people in Sunset Park, but we've been training organizations around the city to become incubators so that now the incubation is happening all around the city by these community-based organizations. But there's also other incubators and technical assistance providers around the country that are very much accessible and ready to help people that are wanting to start co-ops. For example, Green Worker Academy is in the Bronx, and they've been doing this for a long time. And then on a national level, there is the Democracy at Work Institute that are prepared, they're advisors that are in cooperatives that have been trained to provide technical assistance. So there is a lot of resources and help to be able to work with small groups of people, large groups of people, with whatever ideas that people may have to start co-ops. Definitely.
That's really wonderful to hear. And again, it reminds me at a certain stage in the development of the Mondragon Corporation in Spain, they set up what they call the Mondragon University. Mm-hmm. It actually is a university, has four different campuses in that area mm-hmm. of Mondragon in the north of Spain. And they have an enormous program of training. People interested in starting or growing their co-ops, mm-hmm. They teach them marketing, they teach them internal organization, communication skills, really formalizing everything you've said. And so maybe we can look forward to the United States that we can also develop the kinds of institutions, including universities, yes. that can make this an alternative way of building an economy that isn't subject to the costs, the unemployments, the suffering, and mm-hmm. the less human development that conventional enterprise.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going in that direction. And I know Mondragon has been an example for a lot of us in this community that we look to, as well as the co-ops in Italy. So we're very inspired by that. And I think a lot of people are really pushing themselves in this movement to really make this big.
One last comment, because you remind me with your reference to Italy. Italy has a law, and it's always been a kind of pet peeve of mine that the United States hasn't learned from this famous Italian law. It was passed in 1985, called the Marcora Law in Italy, after the name of the legislator who pushed it through. And what it does, and what the listeners might be interested in, is it gives unemployed people in Italy a choice. Mm-hmm. They can get a weekly paycheck, the way we do in this mm-hmm. country with unemployment compensation. And they can get it for a couple of years, and we're familiar with that. But what the Italian workers have had since 1985 is a second option, a plan B, you might call it. If you find at least, if I understand the law exactly, you find at least 9 other unemployed mm-hmm. people like yourself together, you can all make the following choice: not to get a weekly paycheck for the 2 years or so you're eligible, but to get the entire amount you would have gotten over 2 years mm-hmm. as a lump sum into your hands right now on 2 conditions. Mm-hmm. The first being you have 9 other people who right. do it with you, and the second one is that with those 9 people, or more than 9, you start a cooperative enterprise.
Yes.
Wow.
It's pretty incredible. Thank you.
Unbelievable. The government is saying, we're going to help build a co-op sector. And our belief is we would have given that money to the unemployed worker anyway, mm-hmm. but that unemployed worker would have felt bad about himself or herself for a year and a half or two, yeah. lost contact with their fellow workers, lost contact with their employer, lost contact with their skills. This is not good. Mm-mm. This way we keep them working,
yeah.
and they have a greater incentive to make that job succeed because it's theirs. It's their enterprise. Mm-hmm. And so this is a better way to handle. Wow. And the point of the proof of it is Italy has more co-ops than most European countries precisely because it has done that. And that has sprouted the institutions to help these co-ops. So
incredible.
It's a wonderful lesson for how we ought to be having the government take a step to help the private initiatives like yours that have already succeeded and have proof, a track record to show, would be a remarkable thing. Thank you so much, Vanessa,
for joining
and giving our audience a lesson in the concrete realities of worker co-ops. In the time that we have, I want to respond to a question that came in that, again, is similar, as I often do, with many of the questions that come in. And this question, if I can paraphrase, is philosophical. It says, hasn't society always been affected by scarcity? You know, there isn't enough to go around, whether it's land or water or some skill that we need. In this question, there was reference to a neurosurgeon who has all kinds of specialized skills to cure you of problems. And won't we always, therefore, have a situation where some people demand more than others get in the way of pay or salary or recognition, that somehow scarcity forces us into the kinds of rich versus poor, employer versus employee dichotomies? And I want to respond because I think this is a very important question. First, let me explain this in philosophic terms. Whenever there have been social conditions that a lot of people find oppressive and want to change, those who don't find them oppressive, those who want them to continue, make an effort we call naturalization. In other words, they make the argument that the social condition that others don't want is unfortunately natural. The idea here is, look, when it rains on the day you were planning to have a picnic, what are you going to do? Shake your fist at the sky and say, gee, I'm angry that it rains? You kind of know that it's rain and that you can't control the rain. Rain is just part of nature. So then wouldn't it be clever to suggest that hierarchy in our society, the fact that some have a lot and others have too little, is, like the rain, just a part of nature? Or in this case, has to do with scarcity, with there being not enough to go around, so some people have to get it and others have to do without, and that's just the way it is. I'd like to argue against that. I'd like to argue that social conditions aren't natural, that social conditions are things human beings can, in fact, do something about, can handle in alternative ways. So let's talk about scarcity. Is it always the case that when we have scarcity, some people get and other people don't, that we become harsher with one another, that we become more protective of what we have and more hostile towards people we fear would take things away? I think the historical record is unambiguously that that's not true. Let me give you some examples. We've had power failures in the city of New York where I live from time to time. And you know what some of the most interesting things about power failures have been? The way they have brought New Yorkers together. The scarcity of power made people help each other. If there wasn't enough power to work the elevator in your building, why then you got together with people in the building you didn't even know to help the old persons at the higher floors get down to the ground floor where they could access food and water and their medicines that they needed and so on. People were uncommonly friendly and helpful to one another in the streets when there were no streetlights and you had to navigate getting to your job or your store with help from other people. In other words, scarcity can bring people together to share finding a solution to that problem. It is not true that scarcity requires some to get and others to be frozen out of whatever it is that's scarce. Maybe we can learn from scarcity how to share better amongst ourselves. And there's clear evidence that we often do that when confronted with scarcity. So why not build a society that handles it that way? And that leads me to the key point here. The way a capitalist market system handles scarcity is by rationing. Basically, if there are more people who want something than there is that something available, the people who want it in a capitalist market economy bid for it. If there's 20 people who want ice cream and there's only enough ice cream cones for five of them, then the 20 people start bidding. I'll give you more than the $2 you want. I'll give you three. The other guy says, oh, no, I'll give you four. And what happens is the price of the scarce good keeps going up until more and more people can't afford it. And all we have left are those with the money. So the scarce things go to the rich because they have enough money to pay the price that gets bid up because of this scarcity. Okay, that's a way of solving the scarcity problem by giving the scarce items to a few, those who have the money, and denying it to everybody else. Is that the best way to handle scarcity? Is the best way to distribute something scarce to give it to those who have the most money, regardless of what the needs of people are? Should the ice cream go to the richest, or maybe to those who haven't eaten for 2 days? Maybe those who don't get enough. Maybe those who have young children who need that to grow. Aren't there other criteria other than the money that ought to determine what is done with scarcity? It's the same kind of question. How do you handle scarcity? Scarcity can make us act more cooperatively with one another, more humanely with one another. But that's not the way our economic system solves scarcity. But because capitalism doesn't solve scarcity in a humane way, doesn't mean we are required to do that. It means we can find other ways. Just like the program today talked about other ways to organize the workplace, there are other ways to organize whatever scarcities arise, including how collectively we can overcome the scarcity so we don't have the problem in the first place. Allocating things to the richest, just like organizing the workplace so a few people give all the orders, is not the only and not the best way to go. That's not just a criticism of the way things are. That's a solution for how to do it better. Thank you very much for staying with me on Economic Update today. I hope you've learned as much as I have from our guest, Vanessa Brandsburg, and that you will join us again next week for Economic Update. Gonna be my time, babe. Thing gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.